Hi, this is Daryl Lando in Toronto, Canada. You're listening to the Happy Pod from the BBC World Service.
I'm Nick Miles, and in this edition...
The film's about love and compassion as much as anything. Whether it's to an animal or a human being, the more you give to something or somebody that's in need, the more you get back.
The couple who saved a wild otter cub tell us how it's changed their lives. Also...
I need every time if I want to go somewhere ask. I felt helpless.
The technology offering freedom to some people with cerebral palsy and the power of telling someone else's story.
When Ivy Apu told me about her story, I felt like she is actually a light that world needs to see.
We start with a story about kindness and compassion, two things we often talk about on the Happy Pod, but in this case, it's towards a wild otter. Billy and Susan Mail spotted a starving otter cub outside their home on the Scottish island of Shetland 3 years ago. They nurtured her back to health and named her Molly. But the couple say she's the one that's transformed their lives. And the extraordinary story has now been made into a film. The Happy Pod's Holly Gibbs spoke to Susan and Billy, who explained he first spotted Molly catching crabs and eating them on a floating pontoon outside their house.
Curiosity got the better of me and I thought, I wonder how close I can get to this wild otter, because otters are wild. You cannot get near them. So when she was under the water fishing, I ran down the pontoon, sat down, camera in hand, just in case. And sure enough, she caught a crab and she came straight out of the water, sat right in front of me, about a metre away, and ate the crab. And halfway through, she turned and looked me straight in the eye and then went back to eating her crab. And that was the moment when I realised that's not normal. This otter should have run away. So I could see she was really thin. She was emaciated and she was starving. I could see the way she was eating her food. She was desperate. And that was the moment I thought, well, do you know what? I can help you. I can give you fish to eat.
Did she keep coming back to find you then?
Well, so initially I put a box on the pontoon to stop the seagulls getting the fish, and I put fish inside it and the fish would disappear. And I had no idea where it was going. Until one day I was putting the fish down and Molly popped out of the water and caught me. And I think that was the moment that she made the connection between the food source and me. After that, I would find myself working outside and she would come up out of the water and come up the beach and come to me.
Here was this little girl who just wanted some fish. And she quite enjoyed the company. So she would hang out. You know, she would sit about, even after she'd eaten, she would hang about. And so it was really nice then to sort of take a break from what you were doing and go out and interact with her a little and then watch her swim away. Because once she decided she was going, she was gone. So that was your little, sometimes 5 minute break, sometimes 20 minute break. So that's what made it really nice.
Yeah, a dose of Molly a day.
Exactly.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
How unusual is it for otters to have this relationship with humans?
I think it's pretty unusual, to be fair. Wild otters, especially in Shetland, they are wild. They don't want to interact. If they see a human, they're gone. If they see you first, you'll probably not see them. So it is actually really unusual.
So now a film has been made about your relationship with Molly. How does that feel, knowing that you have taken this otter in and now it's become a bit of a phenomenon?
It's a bit overwhelming at times. If you stop and think and look at what's really going on. But it's been a whole bunch of fun as well. We've really enjoyed the journey and we've met some really amazing people. I mean, the filming was hard work because we had to go and film as soon as Molly turned up, and she's random. So sometimes she'd turn up at 6 in the morning, sometimes it was midday. One day it was 10 o'clock at night in a snowstorm, and we went out to film. So it was hard work, but it was fun hard work and really rewarding. What's life if you can't share the good stuff with other people?
There are beautiful scenes. There are sad-ish scenes. There are emotional scenes. It moves the whole time, and it can take you from a high to a low and then back up again quite quickly. Mm.
Ultimately, this story about you nurturing an otter back to health is one about kindness, because you saw this animal that needed your help and you decided to help. How does that feel to know that you have changed this otter's life?
It feels amazing. I was brought up with animals, wild animals, domestic animals, and it's just natural for me as a person to help an animal that's in need. So when Molly turned up, I there was no second thought. I could see she was hungry. I could see she was going to pretty much die of hunger. But she was healthy. There was a sparkle in her eye. I knew she wasn't ill. So it was a natural thing to do.
Billy and I have talked about this together because it's not just about an otter. It's about a human. It's about any animal. It's about anything that if you recognise someone is needing some help, something is needing some help, give it, because you feel better. You do, not in terms of you pat yourself on your back and you say, oh, aren't I great? But it just gives you a better feeling.
I often say to people, you know, the film's about love and compassion as much as anything. Whether it's to an animal or a human being, the more you give to something or somebody that's in need, the more you get back. Not that you give to receive, but it's a really rewarding experience. And I think in Molly's case, it was just so rewarding to see an animal that was going to die, to see her live, but not only live, to see her live the life of a wild otter, go away, mate, have her own young, and then we see her with her own young going around in the water. It's just really rewarding to see that circle of life happening right in front of your eyes and to know that you were a key part of it.
Holly Gibbs was speaking to Billy and Susan Mayle. And you can watch Billy and Molly, an otter love story, on Disney Plus and National Geographic. Now to a new invention aimed at giving some people with disabilities greater freedom and control over their lives. Those with uncontrollable movements from conditions like severe cerebral palsy can find it difficult to smoothly steer their own electric wheelchairs, making them reliant on others whenever they want to go somewhere. But a new system that uses artificial intelligence can help by learning about their individual movements and what they're likely to want to do. The device can be fitted to most existing powered wheelchairs and currently costs around $10,000. The BBC's Ben Morris, who has spinal muscular atrophy and uses a powered wheelchair himself, he controls with a joystick. He says for him, it represents freedom. He went to Flanders in Belgium to find out more about how AI could give that same freedom to others.
My name is Levi. I am 22 years old and I was born with dyskinetic cerebral palsy.
Levi is a young lad with a trendy Adidas tracksuit. As we talk, he nods his head vigorously when he agrees and frequently collapses into giggles. As you can hear, Levi cannot speak, but instead uses a computer-generated voice. He tells the computer what to say by selecting characters on a screen, which tracks his eye movement. Until recently, though, he couldn't move around easily by himself.
I need every time if I want to go somewhere ask. I felt helpless.
Now, I know from experience what this feels like. When my chair occasionally does break down, I have to rely on someone to constantly be there. You literally lose all control. Levi did have access to a powered wheelchair, which he could operate using pads near his head, but it was very difficult, and the chair would sort of stop and start unpredictably.
So typically what happens with people with cerebral palsy, they actually cannot control the range of motion.
This is Frederick Verven from a startup company called CoMoveIt.
So if you and me want to drive to the right, for instance, we push our head to the right against the pad. But when people with cerebral palsy want to do that with involuntary movements, they will do that in a staggered way.
CoMoveIt's solution to this, artificial intelligence.
It actually measures the way that the person is handling the control in the wheelchair and adapts automatically to actually filter all those involuntary movements out. So there is a smooth way of driving.
I am steering with my head and actually lemurating using my foot.
We're in a patio area with large flower beds laid out in a grid pattern. I watch as Levi drives around the patio without once falling into any of the flower beds. As he continues to drive, I notice that the movements become even smoother. Frederick tells me that that's because CoMoveIt's device is improving its profile of Levi.
Mate, honestly, you look so happy. You've got the biggest smile. Much happier than you were in your manual chair. I can just sense it.
But Levi isn't just happy, he's relaxed. Much more relaxed than when he tried using a power chair without the AI device, as Levi's dad tells me.
Levi was typically doing very big moves like this, overstretching both in his back as in his arms. And we see now that that complete tension is out of his body.
The same system can be connected with devices around the home.
He's already controlling our TV, which is sometimes a problem, but he controls fully the Apple TV systems. He controls the sound. He controls his air conditioning in his own room.
Yeah.
He can open doors and close doors. But the biggest challenge is on the TV, I can tell you that, with his sisters who takes control. But the fact that he can take an independent approach and switch the channels gives him a real sense of independence, and it's what he likes to do. And
the real benefit of CoMovit's device for Levi is the freedom it's given him to get out and about.
If I go somewhere, I just go. I put my music on and I go.
Levi, ending that report by Ben Morris. And you can hear more on People Fixing the World, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now to a woman from Bangladesh who's turned what could have been the worst day of her life into a positive drive to help and inspire others. Jenatwal Firdaus Ivy was left with burns covering 60% of her body when she survived a house fire. But instead of retreating from the world, Ivy became a disability rights activist. Now, a dance theatre piece called Rising Lioness has been created about her by Aditi Roy, the founder of CIC Dance Company. The Happy Pod's Siobhan Leahy spoke to Ivy and Aditi.
When Ivy Apu told me about her story, I felt like she is actually a light that world needs to see, a very bright light. I wrote the story and show it to her and I say, is it, you like it? And she said, yes. When she said yes, then I said, like, okay, I'll go ahead with that.
You had her, Ivy's approval.
Oh, yes, of course.
And yeah. Ivy, how did it feel for you to, when you found out your life story and your work was going to be transformed and portrayed in a performance in the theatre?
Some of the filmmakers and novelists, they expressed their interest that they want to write a novel, they want to make a film based on my story. I didn't allow, actually, because they were men and they're very young men, and I was thinking that the complexities, it's not like gender, that complexities of my life, they're not getting it properly. So I didn't allow it. It's not the proper time yet. But when Aditi, actually, she contacted with me, I really found that through the dance performance, on the very first moment, I really agreed that it's different because I found it proper inclusion.
Have you seen any of the rehearsals or any of the progress? And what are your thoughts?
Speechless. I couldn't believe it. Is it possible what they are going to perform?
What was it that you were really keen was portrayed in the show about your story?
From the inclusion part, I said always that we are invisible in the society. Burn survivors are always hiding themselves.
And how do you, Aditi, how do you tell a story like Ivy's without any dialogue?
I always felt dance itself, it's a language. So I want to express on that language what I want to say to all of the audience. It's a small story to find your inner beauty. Not only burn survivor, but every individual being, we are being shamed by the colors, by the shape, by lots of ways, you know, body shaming. Above all, you need to love yourself. Am I accepting myself? Am I saying I'm beautiful in front of the mirror? That is the most important message for me.
You've spent a lot of time with Ivy now. What is it about her that you think is beautiful?
She is extremely a positive person. She is never say anything bad, like never. She say everything going to be fine. Don't worry. It's coming its way. It's coming.
Can I ask a question which might sound a bit cliche, but how do you learn to love this new version of yourself?
I love this new version of my life, totally. I think actually I always say that the beauty, it depends on me. So this new version is more confident. I'm grateful to that accident that, thanks God, you gave me huge experience in this world. So, and the other way, it's meaningful life. The thing is, we are fighting each and every day of our second of our life against the mirror. When I accept it, yeah, I am whatever I am. I think I am beautiful, always.
Coming up in this podcast.
It's very much possible. I just want to inspire girls. I want to talk to them. I want to show them that it's very much possible. We should not shy off. We should just come in and have that self-belief that we can do it.
Meet the first female head coach in Kenya's men's Premier League. As we record this podcast, COP29 is at its halfway point in Azerbaijan. The conference takes place every year and is an opportunity for world leaders to make decisions on how to best combat climate change. As it got underway, the climate charity UST announced plans to protect or restore 1 million hectares of threatened forest in Africa, Asia and South America. The Thriving Forest Scheme will give support and at least $30,000 each to 8 organisations that help Indigenous and local people protect the forests while also making a living. Anna Murphy spoke to Noor Febriani, who works for one group receiving a grant, Alam Sehat Lestari in Indonesia.
We work to conserve the biodiversity of Indonesia's tropical rainforest. We started by sitting together with the community, asking them about the problem and solutions. Among them is that we provide healthcare for the community surrounding the forest because usually the community have poor access. We have fixed clinic, we have mobile clinics where patients can pay with seedlings and then we plant those seedlings in the degraded forest area.
What made you want to get involved in conservation work?
We have only few remaining forests and we need to keep it standing. I believe that all the people everywhere, because we live in the same planet, we are connected. Our health depends on the nature's health.
And this forest protection scheme, how did you first find out about it and that you were going to be a part of it?
When they started to select partners, we applied and then we get email. I feel like, oh my God, because this year ASRI is very struggling. So this support means a lot for us. We do the work in the remote area, so we need the strength of the communication. And then we really hope that, of course, this can sustain what we do, continue, and then support ASRI to be able to bring the successful model to the remaining forests in Indonesia.
And you've seen the success in terms of the rehabilitation of nature. What kind of feedback have you had from the people themselves in the community?
They feel happy with the restoration because they ask for reforestation. So we come and work with them. They also, being part of the reforestation, they earn money from that as well. For example, by doing the land clearing or weeding or maintenance. So it is part of the livelihood also. This is really win-win solution.
You said that you can see the wildlife returning as these forests are growing back and, you know, it's right in front of you, the success that you've had. What is it like for you to see that?
Wow, that is how we feel satisfied to the work. That means a lot. Like something that is different if you work and then you get paid. But this is different because you work and then you see this is really works. When you saw the photos, the videos of the orangutan walking freely and then the beautiful hornbill just hang out, that's different. I feel that really meaningful that I'm doing a good thing and it works. And I want to show it to the world that this is really works here. And then maybe it can also work in other places.
That was Noor Febriani. The largest coral ever recorded has been found by scientists in the southwest Pacific Ocean, close to the Solomon Islands. Researchers believe the healthy and thriving mega coral could be several hundred years old. Georgina Renard reports from the COP29 summit in Baku, Azerbaijan.
This huge coral isn't a reef. It's one organism made up of billions of tiny creatures forming one colony. Scientists diving in remote waters off the Solomon Islands found it by accident. On the map, its location had been marked as a shipwreck. Manu San Felix was freediving with his son Iñigo when he spotted it. Speaking from his research ship, he told me he is in awe of the coral.
I was blown away, fascinated, looking to this amazing coral, and with a big smile and excited, and thinking, wow, this is really special.
The National Geographic team used tape measures to calculate the coral's size. At 32 metres long and 34 wide, it is bigger than a blue whale. It's lived in the remote part of the Pacific Ocean for perhaps 500 years. But globally, coral in warm waters is facing severe risk of extinction as they struggle to survive on a warming planet. And this week, nearly 200 countries are meeting at a major UN climate summit. At the exhibition stand of the Pacific nation Palau, delegates have plastered the walls with photographs of turtles and fish swimming in clear blue waters.
This discovery has happened at the same time as the UN climate talks in Baku in Azerbaijan. And these people here are all part of small island nations and their governments coming here to say that coral reefs and their communities are at real risk from the ocean warming caused by climate change.
In Baku, I spoke to the Solomon Islands climate minister, Mr. Trevor Manhimahaga, about the discovery of coral on the shores of his country.
Coral reefs is very important. Our economy depends very much on marine and fisheries for its survival. We take heart from it. We take pride from it. And it's important for the world to know that it's a special place and it needs to be protected.
In shallower waters near the new discovery, reefs are diseased or dying. But this huge, centuries-old coral has managed to survive. Scientists are calling it a beacon of hope that they want to learn from.
Georgina Rannart. As a child, she had to sneak out of her house to play football. But now, Jacqueline Juma has become a trailblazer for women in the sport. After earning a football scholarship in high school and playing for the Kenyan national team, she is now the first female head coach in the country's men's Premier League. Jacqueline has already made a winning start in charge of FC Talanta and hopes the role will inspire more women and girls to follow their footballing dreams. She's been speaking to Caroline Barker.
At first, they were shocked. They were nervous. They were not so sure, but I told them, hey, we go to classes, we get this knowledge in order to experience. So, yeah, we can do this. So I convinced them and they were okay. After winning the first match, I said, you can do this. I told them, the only thing I need is your support.
Have they always supported you? What was it like when you were growing up and you wanted to play football?
Actually, it was not easy for me because by then my parents had this notion that football is only for boys. So I used to sneak out and go play with my brother. But when I come back, oh my God, it used to be chaos. When I joined my high school, my parents could not pay my school fees. So that is when my parents realized, this football then can really shape up life. It can really pave ways. So after that, they started supporting me. When I got my first call up in the national team, they were like, so this thing is really, it's really true. They started supporting, but it was not easy to convince them that girls can also play football.
I wonder how they feel now because they nearly stopped your dream, I guess.
So they realized that football is a big thing. And it only needs support. And actually, they started even encouraging our neighbors who had girls to go and play. They were the ambassadors of girls playing football in our village. And actually, we formed even a team from our area for only girls.
And you started that. That was all because of you sneaking out. And now look at what you're doing. Do you see that you're having an effect as well on young girls that want to play football? Now they can see what you're doing from your playing career to now coaching in the men's league.
In all my interviews, I told them that I'm representing them and I want to inspire them that, yes, they can. We want to break that circle that female coaches cannot coach men's team. Because if men's team can coach ladies' teams, why not? Vice versa, it can happen as well. So I keep on inspiring them. I keep on telling them to get to these classes. I also have a girls team, under 13 girls team and under 15 girls team. So I normally tell the upcoming coaches to come to my sessions. They come and acquire the experience. They come and try and gain the confidence that they need. I still need to get like a large pool, not only in Kenya, but even Africa and the entire world, that it's very much possible. I just want to inspire girls. I want to talk to them. I want to show them that it's very much possible. We should not shy off. We should just come in and have that self-belief that we can do it.
And you can hear the full interview on the BBC World Service Sports Hour podcast. And that's almost it from the Happy Pod for now. But we had our first listener introduction in this episode, and Daryl also told us a bit about why he tunes in.
I listen to the Happy Pod just like I listen to all the BBC Global News, because I really like quality news and I like getting some good news. I have a visual problem, so podcasts really help pass the time and transport me. So thank you.
And if you want to introduce a future episode, send us a voice note. Just say your name, where you are, and the words you're listening to the Happy Pod from the BBC World Service. And if you like, you can also add a bit about yourself or why you listen. As ever, the email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Sydney Dundon, and the producers were Holly Gibbs and Rachel Bulkley. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.